Well, I think the interesting thing is we probably politically agree a lot and theoretically don't agree at all. The piece I've just been writing over the summer, which is sort of the next stage. As I said at the beginning, this is the first chapter of a series of things on imaginary futures. And I was interested because there's lots of theories that have come out about explaining what's happened in the last 200 years and where we're going to. And I suddenly dawned on me that actually what a lot of these theories are is they're what I decided to call un-Marxism. In the Cold War, people had, they couldn't, people, particularly in the West, could not actually use this basic breakthrough in intellectual life, and even in the East, of course, it was, in a sense, Stalinist Marxism was also a form of un-Marxism. And it's interesting that you use evolutionary biology because, of course, it's actually the other way around. It started as a theory of social evolution in Adam Smith and Adam Ferguson, and then was developed most notably, as I said, in the late 19th century in our great, the great refugee in London, Karl Marx. And of course, now you have to use biology, which actually was modelled on this idea of social evolution, to actually avoid talking about social evolution. So talking about blind moles in the Kalahari Desert or ants and this sort of thing seems in one way absurd because actually, in a sense, what you're doing is you're reducing the human directly to the biological without talking about this long history where we emerged from our past, our ape past. Henri Lefebvre, the great French theorist, and he said, all we're doing is constructing anti-nature. In a way, human evolution, the reason why we're plastic is because we're human and actually our consciousness has changed a number of times, as Adam Smith pointed out in The Wealth of Nations. And so I think the problem we have here is, as I said, I would not disagree what you say about the corporation. The corporation is the domination of dead labour over living labour in many ways, and it's perfected itself. And I live in a... I work in an institution that's devoted to total quality management. Actually, this sort of surreal thing where you go to meetings and they talk these things and you suddenly think, I've read the book where this comes from. So I think that would be my major take on this. It's what some friends of mine call biobabble is my problem with it, is that we should respect our own history and also respect the way people have thought about how capitalism evolved. And capitalism is a very peculiar institution. It's very novel. People who I know who come from societies or parents, grandparents come from societies which are not capitalist, it's very obvious the huge difference between the sort of society we live in. And so that would be my response. And in a way, I would not disagree that you could see the corporation as the artificial intelligence. As I was saying, Herbert Simon thought the computer and the corporation would fuse into one giant mainframe. My worry would be to actually refuse to actually to think about social theory, because I think your science fiction would probably be a lot better if you went to a capital reading group.
I'm not going to disagree with any of that either. I should point out that my background is not in the social sciences, but in the biological and computing sciences, so I'm using the metaphors that come to mind most easily for me. In many respects, I think the story of the blind men feeling their way around the elephant springs to mind here. Capitalism is certainly a very gnarly, very big elephant to feel your way around, and I think in general, the more metaphors we can throw into it that match up different aspects of a problem, the better.
But when I debated Dawkins, I just said to him, well, what's a meme? It sounds like possession by spirits. It's a religious concept. If you won't talk about markets, social forces, class, economics, obviously you have to do these dodgy biological analogies. And so then he got really angry and said, oh, no, we can. One day people will discover memes under a microscope like DNA, and then he's mad. Because it's a way, it seems to me that it's a way of evacuating a whole series of human thought, as I said, which ironically biology has lifted from and forgotten where it lifted it from. So what Marx wrote to Engels, I've just read the Origin of the Species and Darwin sees in nature Manchester economics, competition. social evolution. I mean, so in a way, as I said, it's funny because what happens, you get, particularly among, I'm afraid to say, our American cousins, is at first an complete unawareness of the social origin, the fact that the concept of creating evolution is a historical concept in itself, that it was invented in certain places at certain times. It's not surprising it was invented by Victorian English. You know, the liberals invented it. And then what you do is then, what you're doing is then creating what became called social Darwinism. It's Herbert Spencer who thought, Herbert Spencer is famous, I should say, in England because he opposed the building of a sewage system in London because he thought that diseases like cholera was encouraging the survival of the fittest. You know, and the state was intervening with the market was a natural phenomenon, which even the reading of Adam Smith would tell you that it's not a natural phenomenon, it's a historical creation. So this is my worry about, as soon as you go into this dodgy biological analogies, you're in a way denying that humans can evolve. And then you then say there is this danger of saying that somehow the corporation, which is a transient social form like the medieval kingdom or, you know, oriental despotism, is an eternal and transhistorical construction. And even I think, I've worked with corporations, I know people work with corporations, and they are incredibly shambolic organizations, and that's this other side that doesn't come out in this sort of biological story.
I'm going to disagree with you conditionally here. I think that the biological metaphors have an awful lot to offer political and social analysis. One example I'd like to coin just to point this out is, up until about the 1920s, biology was a very distinct science from chemistry. One of the most interesting scientific phenomena of the late 20th century was the emergence of the field of molecular biology and of biochemistry, which at a stroke did not destroy pre-existing biological science, but provided a rationalistic underpinning for it at the level of chemistry. Now, while I would not dispute that it is very easy to misuse biological ideas, especially in the context of social Darwinism or, you know, through misapplication to political and social systems, I think that a lot of the understanding of evolutionary theory within social sciences dates back to what is essentially the 19th century state of the field, when Darwin was having his idea. It was picked up with and run with by a lot of people who were not necessarily part of a biological sciences community. And it's rather odd because in scientific terms, evolutionary theory has become almost something of a backwater. Certainly modern genetics has a relatively limited connection to it in practice. Excuse me. Now, sorry, I've dead-ended there.
Well, I was just saying, it makes a very good form of un-Marxism, because it's a way of avoiding talking about the evolution of capitalism, except in these very abstract biological metaphors, rather than seeing the nitty-gritty of how these systems have evolved. And the evolution, you know, the evolution, I'm sorry just to be train-spotting here, you're driving someone out already. I mean, it's what's interesting for someone, like, I mean, I'm trained as a historian, I've done politics, I've done economics, so generally in social sciences, the reverse has happened. All these things, you know, it used to be called political economy, now it's called politics or economics, or history, or social theory, or sociology. And in fact, actually, it's interesting that one of the things that these dodgy biological metaphors are doing is trying to actually grasp what social theories of the 19th, 18th, 19th century did, which is to see them as a totality of human social development. And but the thing is, they can't engage in the central one, because the problem is the key scientific breakthroughs of the late 19th century pointed out that we live in a class society based on exploitation. And that's something that you can't talk about, especially now. And that is part of the problem with these biological metaphors, is that what they don't talk about is the extraction of surplus value or something like this, because it's not allowed. You're not allowed to say this. It's not an acceptable way of thinking about society. Anyway, maybe we should throw the questions open to the audience.
Voilà, donc si vous avez des questions, c'est le moment. Before we get into it. On va donc prendre un groupe de questions. Donc s'il y a plusieurs questions, voilà, on va passer la parole ici. Donc, I take a few questions and you answer all at the end.
I have a question for Richard. You concluded your talk with wondering what, saying that we need new visions for the future, you know, trying to re-envision our future, and asking the question, what actually is the use of envisioning new futures? And I was wondering, do you have an answer to that yourself?
Maybe I'll think about it. Yes, I do in a way, and I think I did hint at it by bringing up Norbert Wiener's idea of cybernetics as a two-way process. I mean, I think that is one possibility. And then certainly, as I said, this is where I'd agree with Charlie. Actually, I would say that some idea... I mean, I've been one of the people who promoted the gift economy, which I think in some ways is another dodgy imaginary future from the 1960s, actually, in this case. But I think it does have elements, this idea that we could live in a society of information abundance. And I think that's actually a doable future. It's a practical future. In fact, it's really here in a way. It's just that the legal system and the politicians and the corporations haven't quite caught up with it. Though some of them have, interestingly. I mean, I always loved the Apple Macintosh advert that said, rip, mix, burn. And then it had a little asterisk at the bottom and it says, do not break the copyright laws. So, yeah, you can have software communism, but you have to have hardware capitalism with it. That's maybe the flip side. An ultra question?
I still have a feeling that we are avoiding speaking of
the future. We're avoiding the future. Yeah, it is an introduction. What I introduced today, should I go back? If I can go back, originally I said I thought it was quite funny that I was down to talk about this article I wrote 5 years ago. And when I wrote it, as I said, it was I thought that what I should do is extend it out and try and actually think about why we think about the future. And one of the things I hopefully was showing today, that one of the reasons we think about the future, as Charlie said, is because it's a way of thinking about the present. Yes, but the thinking about past futures is to understand how we do the future. I mean, they said that interesting thing about St. Pancras, so you have the present, but you pretend it's the past. Now we have the present, and we pretend it's the future. And so maybe one of the problems about is not just thinking about new futures, but actually to think about the present in a more sensible way.
So what do you think of the present?
Well, I'm a left social democrat. I don't know where you are. That's because I'm a cynical leftist, Marxist, whatever, but, you know. What? Well, that's, you know, I don't know, I mean, you know, I would oppose, you know, I think, so on one level you could say there's a, you know, that, you know, there's a, again, you know, there's that problem, you know, you can have those problems in theory and you can have them, but actually really it's what do you do in practice, that seems to me the, and in a way, as I said, maybe futures and particularly imaginary are a way, I mean, particularly I was trying to say here, the imaginary futures were a way of hiding in a way, you know, like when I was a kid and looked at these rockets and think they are John Glenn or Yuri Gagarin, but actually what they are is blowing people up. So maybe one of the things is if maybe is to, you know, partly we should think about futures because we need to know where we're going to. This is what I hope people like Charlie are doing, even if I disagree with their theories. They probably are taking us in the right direction. But also I think maybe my job is to think about the present, actually to understand the sort of society we live in. Because it seems to me, as I said, I'm in the Labour Party and we have a leader who completely misreads the present, let alone the future, and does disastrous things, you know. So this seems to be maybe, and it seems to be a generalised phenomenon among lots of people, so maybe that's what social theorists should do, is trying to help people understand the present better, because then we can act pragmatically to create a better future. Work, practice, vote, organise, create better technology. Yeah, but we voted a good mayor into London, so It does work sometimes. Hey, in Spain they changed the government, you know. No. Voting won't change the world, but it can change the government.
The topic of intellectual property is one that's sort of close to my heart because I've got two attitudes to it. Now, I basically make my living completely through the creation of what I could joke I've referred to as a paradox of intellectual property. I write fiction, I've been known to write software, I've been a freelance journalist for many years. I live or starve by the product of my word processor. So, on the one hand, I have a good incentive for wanting to lock my intellectual property down tight and charge everybody lots of money for using it. Unfortunately, I'm also a consumer of intellectual property. I like reading books, I like listening to albums, I do the rip, mix, burn thing, I have an iPod. And, you know, when the boot is on the other foot, paying through the nose for the intellectual property gets suddenly much less attractive. And it's at this point that I realise that as an individual, a self-employed individual, not a corporate, who wants to create, what I really want is to have enough money to live on in return for doing what I want to do. And the reason there is a paradox is not because of any intrinsic feature of the nature of information, but because of the way our laws for providing for the remuneration of authors and artists have evolved. Copyright law in its present form dates back to the 18th century, I think.
Statute of Anne, 1707.
Right. And it was explicit in those statutes that the objective of granting rights in any copies of a work that was made was to ensure that authors and artists would be rewarded.
It was so that publishers would be rewarded. Printers, actually. It's designed to protect printers.
Ah,
it's English liberalism, you know.
Well, the
that's the French. It's the droit moral is different. That's the that's the French idea. It's the create. It's Hegel, isn't it? Hegel thinks it's property is the expression of the creative individual, while the English think that it's labour that can be bought. As John Locke says, property is that which me or I or my servants mix their labour with. And therefore, what they want to do is create property and information because everything else is bought and sold. And so, therefore, if you want to have novelists, people like you, who can you can buy and sell, you have to be able to create a property. But it's interesting because it's not a bourgeois property right. Because a bourgeois property right is once you sell it, you can do what you like with. But the interesting thing about copyright is you sell something to somebody, and it's more like a feudal property right because you still have control over the thing that you've just sold. And that's one of those interesting contradictions that neoclassical economics gets completely confused about. So you have Milton Friedman, who actually is against copyright and is one of the loony professors of the Chicago School. And then you have other people who think that everything should be property. Every time you think, I mean, I've worked with people who said, when I left their job, said, I own the ideas you have. And I'm going, that's completely insane. I mean, that is capitalism running mad.
Yeah. The further away from a concrete object that we take property rights, the more debatable they become. And we do have a very serious problem with the way that copyright has been extended. First, it was post-mortem copyright. Copyright originally existed for a period of a few years, which could be renewed by the author. But this was then extended in the 19th century by a parliament that had been implored by the widows and orphans of dead writers and their publishers to extend copyright after the deaths of those authors so that their loved ones could be taken care of and their publishers could make some profits. And it has now reached the absurd point where in the United States, is it 95 years after
the Mickey Mouse law? Copyright is however long it is since Mickey Mouse was invented.
Yeah. 95 years post-mortem. Let me put that in perspective. Supposing I'm run over by a bus tomorrow and my wife is pregnant. She will be dead of old age. Her child will almost certainly be dead of old age. Grandchildren who we've never met would be the likely beneficiaries of that particular law, except I'm not famous, I'm not Stephen King. 90% of authors' works go out of print within 2 years of the author's death, never to be reprinted. 98% of them are out of print within a decade. A 95-year copyright extension actually destroys much intellectual property by rendering it completely inaccessible. There's a very interesting book I have been reading a Samizdat copy of lately. I really want to try and find a publisher for this book, which was published by an academic press in the mid-1970s. It was published once only. The author died at least 10 years ago. Other friends of mine have been trying to track down his relatives with no success. In a sensible regime for copyright, it would be a no-brainer. We could bring the book back into print. But as things are, we may have to hunt down the heirs to this fellow, who have no idea of what Granddaddy used to do because it was classified, explain to them that they are indeed the heirs to this intellectual property, which we would like to bring back into print, and no, this is publishing, and I'm terribly sorry, but if you're lucky, you'll see £200 for this. And these obstacles are insuperable because most people have very strange ideas about how much money a 30-year-old book is worth. So, in many cases, the laws on intellectual property that have grown up recently are not so much protecting intellectual property as actually strangling it. And one of the things we need to do is simply reconceptualize how we want to reward the creative endeavor to encourage more of it.
But I mean, to come back to this idea of imaginary futures, this is because one of the concepts behind the information society, the knowledge economy, which is why they have these World International Property Organization, which is part of the WTO and all the rest of it, is because they have this vision of an information economy where everybody will spend all their day buying and selling information to each other. And some of us will make a living out of it. And the corporations, obviously, who employ the people who buy and sell, make the information they buy and sell, are in favour of it, and they lobby and pay the politicians to pass the laws. But the difficulty is then you pass laws which are unenforceable. You know, we had stringent laws against men having sex with each other in England, but I saw this great documentary about people in the 1950s who, it seems that lots of them men had sex with each other in the 1950s. So the law was obviously an idiot. And in England, we have the most draconian drug laws in Europe and the highest drug consumption per head. So it's one of these things that where we, as a social democrat, I have to say this, we should not pass laws that bring the law into disrepute. And this seems to be a classic example where almost everybody, like gay men or drug users, is breaking the law on a daily basis in some cases. And so it's actually this strange thing that the law gets tighter and tighter, the corporation's ambitions get greater and greater, and it becomes less and less enforceable, and more people break the law. So in the sense, you have a formal position and a real position. And this seems to be, to come back to politics, which I know you want to avoid, seems to be actually quite a dangerous position to have, where you're encouraging people to think the law is an ass, because occasionally you want people to obey the law. So you should only pass sensible laws which can people want to obey and will obey spontaneously, with any luck.
Well said.